It's time to turn attention to another form of stricture that is often brought upon developing and poor countries around the world, economic stricture, which limits and specifies just how poor countries should spend money or refrain from spending money on educating their children or providing health care to their people. This has happened throughout Central America and South America and Africa and other countries around the world under the control and strictures of institutions who want monies instead to be spent paying debt relief to the wealthier countries and the institutions which have loaned the money, namely the World Bank, for example. Well, the Middle East is coming under a new framework agreement gradually to participate in these kinds of corporate globalization-driven frameworks for economic development, not under their own choices, not to allow those countries to make the decisions themselves locally on the ground in their own best interests or in the interests of healthcare, education, or clean water, not if it violates the rules of corporate-led globalization. Specifically, many of those rules are laid down by think tanks such as the Project for the New American Century, universally recognized as one of the leaders of neoliberal thought globally and neoconservative thought domestically. One of its former members is Robert Zoellick. Robert Zoellick was appointed recently by the Bush administration to become the number two person at the United States, not the Department of Commerce, no longer a trade representative, but now at the State Department, number two under Condoleezza Rice at the Department of State. Robert Zoellick will be responsible for leading the United States Middle East Free Trade Area. That's what the Bush administration has proposed calling the Middle East. I'm very glad to be able to welcome to the program Project Director at the International Forum on Globalization, Antonia Juhas. Welcome to the program, Antonia Juhas.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Let me just start out by asking you a bit about Robert Zoellick's appointment and what you think that it signals for the development of a free trade, or will it be fair trade, area in the Middle East under United States preferences?
There's a lot to say about Robert Zoellick's appointment. First, to point out that he has been the U.S. trade representative, that is the highest ranking U.S. government official working on trade policy since the beginning of the first Bush administration. And he, as you said, is a neocon. He was a signatory to many of the works of the Project for a New American Century, what has been called the leading think tank of the neocons in Washington. And he is a diehard free trade advocate, definitely not fair trade, but the very conservative idea of eliminating the ability of governments to regulate corporations on behalf of their communities, so that corporations can produce anywhere and everywhere and make as much of a profit as possible. He's actually one of the original drafters of the North American Free Trade Agreement between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. And he's been working back and forth mostly at the State Department for most of his career, and then brought over to the United States Trade Representative's office to implement his conservative ideas directly through trade policy. He has been, in the past 4.5 years, the strongest pusher behind the proposed U.S. Middle East Free Trade Agreement. And actually, it's incorrect to say that long. He's been the main trade advocate for that long. The proposed Middle East Free Trade Agreement only came about, or was only announced in any case, 1 month after the Bush administration invaded Iraq. The president himself announced that what he wanted to do is expand free trade to the entire Middle East region, and that the avenue for doing that would be the proposed Middle East Free Trade Area. And just to set the context, unlike most of the world, the Middle East has actually been fairly immune from having to sign on to such devastating agreements. The main reason has been that they have oil and oil wealth and haven't needed to make the sort of devil's bargain that other countries have, which is, you know, we'll give you anything if you bring us money, if you bring us foreign investments because we're desperate. The Middle East countries have not been desperate in that way. However, U.S. corporations in particular have been desperate to get into the region because for that very reason it's so very wealthy, not to mention the oil, and there's a lot of money to be made. So now with the invasion of Iraq, the Bush administration was essentially able to say, look, we've shown you what we're willing to do. You're going to sign on to the bottom line and let us expand our trade agenda through the more traditional means, the free trade agreement, as opposed to invasion. And Robert Zoellick has been the man who has made that happen in a fairly unprecedented manner.
Let's take a look for a moment at just some of the terminology we're using. In the interests of doing thorough reporting that actually explains the terminology that's been chosen here, free trade and fair trade. In this country, the word freedom and words like liberty are used all the time for people with different purposes in mind. And they're words that are easily used to be somewhat manipulative in communications. So if we could draw a parallel briefly about freedom versus fairness, we talk about freedom in this country, for example, freedom of speech or freedom to bear arms or the freedom to not have unreasonable searches and seizures visited upon us. And these are all freedoms not because the power doesn't exist for people to stop our freedom of speech or to unreasonably search our houses or persons or deny us the right to bear arms, for example. The power does exist. The state has that power to do so. But in fairness, we have more or less agreed in our Bill of Rights that will not happen, and that there will be therefore a kind of a balance that allows both freedom and fairness. And I bring this up just to point out that if we now look at trade, economic activity and trade, and if we examine the analogous situation where there is, say, a dominant trade partner with huge, vast resources of wealth, able to trade with smaller trade partners or individuals, there is a disadvantage there. And freedom is, I would assume, not constituted in the dominant partner being able to do whatever it wants, but in both partners, in fairness, being able to participate and have certain rights. So let me just ask you, Antonia Juhas, in your experience with the International Forum on Globalization, explicitly economic globalization, what have we seen so far in terms of the freedom of both the weaker and the stronger sides in global economic trade to have the freedom to trade in a fair situation? Uh-huh. What's the record look like so far?
Well, I mean, I would basically summarize this discussion as what is termed free trade is essentially policies that make the world free for corporations but highly costly for everybody else, and that the power dynamic actually becomes even delineated more along, do you have powerful corporations in your country even more than are you a quote-unquote powerful country? So the entire policy agenda is clearly stated to make sure that corporations can move around the world. For its advocates, the idea is that they will create a tremendous amount of economic wealth that will then trickle down to the rest of the world, and this is why we want such policies. So the record is that the policies have been extremely successful in moving wealth to corporations and political elites who work with them and shareholders, but extremely terrible at seeing that wealth actually trickle down to the rest of society. Rather, it actually gets more locked at the top because of the rules and is unable to find its way to the rest of society, creating tremendous inequality.
Describe for us the ways that the debt agreements that most poor countries have entered into in order to try to develop, entered into with the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund or the various global lending institutions through the World Trade Organization and other agreements. These countries now are required to pay more in just the interest on that debt than they can use for certain part of their own developments like healthcare and education. Is that right?
Yes, and, you know, there's, basically the situation that we find a tremendous amount of the world in because of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, which are lending institutions, they just lend money, they don't give it as aid, that because of the failure of the policies that the countries are forced to adhere to, they become, in fact, more poor, their economies suffer as opposed to get better, which means that they're being lent money that they are then unable to repay because their economies are not, in fact, improving. And then they become, on top of that, even more indebted due to the interest that they owe now the lending institutions. So you see all across the world countries that are handed a check from the World Bank, which they simply turn around and give back to the bank because of interest that they owe the bank and their incurred debt. This is a problem all around the world, and it's a problem that actually has seen increased attention and should see increased attention right now in the discussion of the tsunami relief, because all of these East Asian countries that have been hit by the tsunami are also heavily indebted to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And one of the calls that is coming from civil society is that one of the best things that the northern countries can do to respond to the tsunami is to cancel the debt of those countries so that they have the ability to recover long term. But to bring this discussion sort of back to Robert Zoellick and the Bush administration in the Middle East, to see the most pure example of how the policies of quote-unquote free trade, neoliberalism, have been can be imposed, one need look no farther than Iraq, because the Bush administration has essentially used the invasion as an excuse to unleash what I call, you know, capitalism gone wild. If you take the most extreme policies from the World Trade Organization, the North American Free Trade Agreement, the IMF, the World Bank, and put them into a wish list, that is what the U.S. has imposed in Iraq. And that model is what Zoellick is trying to implement across the Middle East. And I believe that putting him into this position at the State Department underneath Condoleezza Rice, the most trusted ally of George Bush, will give him an even greater platform from which to combine the ideas of trade policy, free trade policy, and statecraft, which is something that we all need to, you know, pay attention to.
My guest is Antonia Juhas, who is project director at the International Forum on Globalization, who have been educating people around the world and especially in the United States about economic globalization, who leads economic globalization, who sets the rules for how economic globalization will proceed. Their website is available at ifg.org. That's International Forum on Globalization, ifg.org. Antonia Juhas, we're talking about the Middle East and the United States and other countries around the world and regions where these trade agreements have been made, the rules often set by, as you say, the biggest corporations who can lobby to figure out the legal language required and actually have the economic muscle to set the terms and conditions of lending agreements and development structures and who will profit. I'm just interested to note that this strange situation that those of us who don't follow how bank loans work in general, or especially how international bank loans work with the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund, it seems like such institutions backed by such huge corporate concerns who do have to worry about their bottom line are lending money to countries that they know will default on their debt, will not be able to pay back the debt. And then there are very specific terms and conditions spelled out in legal language that the countries have agreed to about what happens if they are unable to pay back their debt. John Perkins is the author of a new book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He claims to have been recruited by the National Security Agency during his last year at Boston University School of Business Administration in 1968, spent some time in the Peace Corps, and then was hired in 71 by the international consulting firm of Charles T. Main, based in Boston with 2,000 employees, very low profile. He became chief economist and director of economics and regional planning at this Charles T. Main consultancy. And the reason I describe all of this background, and incidentally, to see if most of this money apparently ended up at Maine. Also, Bechtel, Halliburton, Brown & Root, and other U.S. engineering and construction companies. The same loans are involved. This John Perkins claims that he was recruited and trained by the U.S. National Security Agency and then resigned in 1981 and then has gone on to do some sort of environmental things and try to develop green power after that. But he points out that this plan, the reason I introduce this in this long manner is to say that here's someone who's saying that this entire sequence we see again and again of making loans to heavily indebted poor countries who then are unable to pay back the debt is understood. It is expected by, for example, him in his position as chief economist, and by the World Bank and the IMF, and other global organizers of the global economy. It's expected, and in fact, what it allows to be done is for new restrictions to be put on those poor countries as to how they'll develop, how their foreign policies will develop. John Perkins goes on to say that even votes at the United Nations are in effect, if not formally and on paper, in effect traded on this basis. And I wonder, Antonio Yuhas, if you've seen examples around the world of the kinds of strictures that poor countries are put into through their essentially being subject under such huge power to the terms and conditions of IMF and World Bank loans. What do countries have to consent to?
Yeah, it's I think it's great that you mention Confessions of an Economic Hitman. It's a really important book. Actually, the same publisher of that book is the publisher of a book that I'm the author of, which tries to present the opposite, which is alternatives to economic globalization, a better world as possible. And we try and present, you know, what the solution would be. But basically what that book talks about is how, you know, the reason why it makes sense for the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and banks that follow their guidelines or follow their path to make loans to countries that they know can't pay them back is that the trade-off is that they get to set the rules by which the countries have to now spend that money. And basically those rules are twofold, both restrictions on the ability to spend money on social services. So basically the argument of the IMF and the World Bank is, well, your country, you know, has put itself into a bad financial situation, so you don't have the luxury of spending money on things like healthcare, education, the environment, other protections. So you're going to have to cut off that spending. And at the same time, you need to attract more income into your country. And the way to do that is to change your laws so that they are more accessible to foreign corporations. And this explains why the corporations are interested in this process. The IMF and World Bank will say you need to reduce the protections that you require for workers, such as benefits and wages, because that makes it more costly for corporations to operate in your country. You need to reduce the environmental requirements you put on corporations, because that makes it more costly. You need to provide incentives to corporations, such as tax breaks and building roads and providing electricity and doing all of these sorts of economic development, but geared specifically at the corporations to encourage them to come. All of this is based on the notion that those corporations will then, as I said, generate a tremendous amount of wealth, which will help that country. But what we've seen instead is also because of the rules. The rules, one of the main things they say, is that corporations do not have to reinvest the money that they make in, say, Indonesia, back into Indonesia. They can send it all back to their home country. So what we see time and time again is corporations coming in, essentially sort of reaping the benefits of, you know, cheap labor, access to resources, cheap production, and sending all of their profits home and then leaving as soon as it becomes cheaper to operate somewhere else. And that is the sort of devastating history of not only these institutions, but that same model is replicated through any place where you see quote-unquote free trade put into practice. So be that the Middle East Free Trade Area, the World Trade Organization, the proposed Free Trade Area of the America, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, all of these are based on the same premise.
We're speaking with Antonia Juhas, project director at the International Forum on Globalization and co-author of the new book, A Better World is Possible. Antonia Juhas, tell us more, if you would, about those organizing in the Middle East or around the world related to the U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area who would oppose this corporate-led model of U.S. globalization, and what alternatives are they advancing?
Well, the first thing to say about the Middle East is that it's an area in which organizing is very difficult. If your listeners have been following the newspapers lately, I think it was yesterday that the New York Times had a story about how 15 protesters in Saudi Arabia were sentenced to 250 public lashes and several years in jail because they had participated in a public protest. This isn't a region where organizing is traditionally acceptable or done in public. It also is a region where there is very little access to information. I have traveled to Lebanon, brought there by many organizations prior to the World Trade Organization's meeting in Doha, Qatar, which happened in 2001, because they wanted to organize just educational events around what is the WTO, why is it coming to our region. And the main thing that they said to me and the other groups that had come was that they don't have access to information. They don't know what their government is negotiating. So there isn't a lot of information about the Middle East Free Trade Area except for among the government leaders that are negotiating it. So groups that are helping to address that situation in the United States that people could certainly find out more about, and some that have setups also in the Middle East, there's a group called Friends of the Earth, which is actually based in London but also has a Washington, D.C. headquarters. And they have a project on the border between, but I forget exactly where they are, but it's in Israel. And they're working on opposing free trade agreements and addressing environmental issues. Another group that is starting to pay attention to this issue is it's called the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, and they're looking at this from an agriculture perspective. And then a group that I believe will be paying more attention to it is one called Public Citizen, which has definitely taken the lead in opposing free trade agreements around the world in the past. And, you know, I would say for your listeners, the best thing to do is to get more information yourself and then see how you can plug into other organizing efforts. And unfortunately, at this stage, the best information on the proposed Middle East Free Trade Area is on the website of the United States Trade Representative's Office, which is ustr.gov. The alternatives aren't in response to this agreement, which I said is very new. Our analysis in our book, which is the full title is Alternatives to Economic Globalization, A Better World is Possible, is rethinking the entire model and basically saying it is a complete fallacy, and it's been proven, that opening countries, forcing them to change their laws to make themselves more attractive to corporations is going to lead to any sort of economic equality, environmental sustainability, social justice, and any of the other goals that we believe very strongly in. And instead, we need a model that puts those values first and then sees trade as just one among many other tools that can help accomplish those goals, but that trade, as opposed to being an end in itself, becomes a means, if that, to other goals. And our book is 5 years in the making. It's a consensus document. There are 20 authors, but it's not different essays. It's 20 authors who agreed on one document that would reflect our position from all around the world, proposing everything from, you know, changes in local tax laws and chartering for corporations to the elimination of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization and alternative institutions that would better serve the interests of the public. And, you know, we feel it's a very good, at minimum, first step to start a dialogue among communities on what they can do locally to implement alternatives in their own locations.
Antonia Juhas, thank you so much for joining us today on Sounds of Dissent.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Antonia Juhas is project director at the International Forum on Globalization. Their website is ifg.org. She's also co-author of a new book, A Better World is Possible, about alternatives to the corporate-led model of economic globalization. You're tuned to WZBC in Newton, 90.3 FM. You can catch this program, Sounds of Dissent, every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m.